clerk will call the doctor.
Honorable Brian Walton, against Carol Clark, director, Paul M. Wiley, for the accounts, Arthur Herring, Attorney General, Timothy Heitz, Solicitor General, Victoria Pearson, Deputy Attorney General, Matthew R. McGuire, Deputy Solicitor General, Christopher P. Shenandoah, Assistant Attorney General, the appellate.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, Your Honors. You may have pleased the court. My name is Paul Wiley. I'm with the law firm of Hogan Lovells in Washington, D.C., and I'm counsel for the appellate in this matter, Monte Walton. I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
All right.
There is very little daylight between this court standard for finality and the standard that's applied in the Fourth Circuit. In order that dismisses a case in its entirety, that disposes of the action in the trial court, is final and appealable. There is not a general presumption against appealability of dismissals without prejudice. The order at issue here, the May 2017 order, dismissed Mr. Walton's case in its entirety because of procedural grounds related to the conduct of the litigation. The court imposed a deadline in its May 2016 order. The court mistakenly believed Mr. Walton had failed to meet that deadline, and the court dismissed the case as a result. This court does not need to go any farther than that to decide that the May 2017 order was a final appealable order and that the court has jurisdiction to decide the appeal. Because there was plain error in the circuit court's order dismissal, the ruling should be reversed, vacated, and the case should be remanded to the circuit court for further proceedings. The May 2017 order was a dismissal on procedural grounds, as you can see by careful reading of the circuit court's reasoning expressed in its order. If you compare the factual findings to the May 2016 order, this is going to be comparing pages 118 and 172 of the joint appendix. In the May 2016 order, the factual findings all deal with deficiencies in the papers, missing content, incorrect format, wrong number of copies. If you compare that by contrast to the May 2017 order, the factual findings all deal with the timing of events during the litigation. When the original deadline was imposed, what the specific deadline was, and whether Mr. Walton had acted in a timely manner. The dismissal was based on how the case had proceeded, not the underlying content of the petition. In federal court, this would have been an involuntary dismissal for failure to prosecute or comply with the court's order under Rule 41B. As we stated in our brief, the federal courts generally agree that an involuntary 41B dismissal is appealable even if it was a dismissal without prejudice. But even in the Fourth Circuit, the fact that this was a dismissal on procedural grounds matters, because we argue that the Fourth Circuit standard is narrower than what was articulated in the director's brief. As I said at the outset, there is not a general presumption against appealability for dismissals without prejudice. If you look at the cases that apply the Domino Sugar framework, none of them speak about this, about creating a presumption that must be overcome by other evidence or other facts.
Okay, I interrupt you with a question about finality.
Of course.
We issued a week or so ago proposed amendments, or not proposed amendments, actually promulgated amendments to Rule 1:1 that are becoming effective on November 1 of this year. Have you had a chance to review those amendments, and if so, how do they square or not square with your proposed view of finality?
To be honest, Your Honor, no. I had not seen the promulgated new amendments. I would be happy to look at them and submit a letter to the court if that was felt necessary. There is certainly some overlap between finality for the 21-day rule and finality for purposes of appeal, although the cases do distinguish the two in some cases.
Well, there's a concerted effort to try to find, you know, some parallelism between those two concepts, because it becomes impossible to administer if we don't.
Of course, Your Honor. And My apologies for not seeing that the...
No, not a problem. Please continue.
Sure, certainly. There was, speaking of recent developments in Virginia law, the Premov against Serco case from just a few weeks ago did speak about the effect of dismissals without prejudice and what they do in the trial court in a way that I think is important in this case, and I will come back to that in just a moment. But going back to the Fourth Circuit standard and how the Fourth Circuit would look at this sort of case, there is no general presumption against appealability. And in fact, the Fourth Circuit expressly disclaims such a standard. If you look at the Go Computer case, they quoted a case, I believe, from the Seventh Circuit saying that the test for finality is not whether the suit is dismissed with prejudice or without prejudice. A standard that there is a general presumption against appealability would create tension with precedent from the Supreme Court of the United States, the Wallace and Tiernan case that we cited in our reply brief. In that case, the court ruled that a case is not unappealable simply because it was dismissed without prejudice.
Well, why is there tension? That's obviously a federal rule and a federal disposition.
We think the principle of law that has been embraced by the Supreme Court of the United States would foreclose any general presumption against appealability, as the director's brief stated is the standard in the Fourth Circuit.
I mean, is that rooted in due process? Is that why that, or is that just persuasive authority? This is how they do it on the federal side. It's wise, it makes sense, so we should do the same thing.
We would say persuasive authority based on sort of the general understanding of finality. The finality statute in federal court, the 1291, the statute on which federal appellate jurisdiction stands, is very similar to the Commonwealth's.
I think our fork in the road is Commonwealth agrees your client's entitled to relief. Factually, sure looks like he's entitled to relief. So we just do an order that says, Circuit Court, you're just mistaken. It happens, so do over. And that's it. It's just an atomized disposition of this case. Or we try to grapple with this problem of dismissals without prejudice and in what circumstances, because we have some cases like with demurs where we've said, no, that's not appealable, and then others where we indicate it is. And so why shouldn't we just take care of this case and then not worry, particularly when we're amending our rules, not worry about some magnum opus on without prejudice?
Certainly, Your Honor, appellant would be very happy with an order that simply sends us back to the trial court, lets us pick up where things left off. I believe that there is, or our position is that a narrow ruling on this is the best case. It is odd facts. There is not a particularly robust factual record. I believe almost the entire thing is in the joint appendix. A narrow ruling that does not get into the sort of theoretical implications of dismissal without prejudice would be the better approach in our position, especially in light of the fact that there is such agreement on how to treat dismissals on procedural grounds like this one with the alternate standard that the Commonwealth and the Director have supported. We believe that because the two are so close, the Court can deal with it very narrowly. And additionally, the Court's precedents support a narrow ruling that does not need to dive into the details of how to treat it without prejudice. The long-standing rules on finality show that this definitely was a final order. In the 1914 case, Brown against Carolina C&O Railway, the court wrote that a judgment is final for purposes of appeal when it is a determination of the particular action or suit. And the language from the Primo case just a few weeks ago, quoting from U.S. against California, was that a dismissal without prejudice terminates the action and concludes the rights of the parties in that particular action. Simply marry those two statements together, and you see that this was a final appealable order. The court can resolve this on a narrow ruling and simply send us back to the trial. Speaking to the underlying question of error, we believe the record very clearly speaks for itself. There's no dispute on the factual matter between the parties. It appears to be a case that simply the pleading got misplaced or lost in the clerk's office. We take the position that the court should be reversed, and we should be able to go back and pick up Mr. Walton's habeas petition in the circuit court.
All right, you have 5 minutes, 46 seconds left.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Matt McGuire on behalf of the Director of Clark. I want to begin by highlighting what this Court has already heard a lot about this morning, which is the agreement between the parties to help narrow exactly how little is in dispute in this case from our perspective. The first is we agree with Walton that the order at issue here qualifies as a final judgment under Code Section 8.01-670A3. We also agree that the Circuit Court here erred by dismissing his amended petition. It appears that the Circuit Court was simply unaware that he had time to file the amended petition in compliance with the Court's order. And lastly, we agree that the case should be remanded for the Circuit Court to consider his amended habeas petition on the merits. The limited nature of the disagreement between the parties is on sort of the metaphysical question Justice McCullough pointed to about how this Court should handle dismissals without prejudice, generally speaking, as final judgments. And we would submit that Walton's position effectively is anything classified as a dismissal, whether of the case or the complaint, qualifies as a final judgment. That does have benefits. As we pointed out in our brief, the U.S. Supreme Court has pointed out that bright-line rules are preferable for jurisdictional issues like this. We just think it's over-inclusive and unnecessarily could burden judicial resources, and that our practical approach that the Fourth Circuit takes, or at least how we read the Fourth Circuit's test, would both be equally protective of litigants' rights while also preserving judicial resources to the extent an issue is better presented to the trial.
Based on your opening statements, can we conclude that we don't need to address the argument you're diving into now to address the issue that's before us?
Justice Powell, I think you could certainly take the approach Justice McCullough outlined to resolve this particular case. This order is appealable, the Circuit Court erred, and send the case back. To the extent the Court wanted to address the larger issue is why we went on to brief it, that it was added to this case as an additional assignment of error.
So quite literally, we agree on everything except that perhaps that last point. So quite literally, you are making a federal case out of it.
In a sense, Justice Bems. It's to the extent the Court is going to write an opinion here about why this order is appealable, what we wanted to get in front of the Court, why we think that it is, but it's important from the Commonwealth's perspective, from the Director.
Well, it's clearly fraught with, I mean, depending on what we do, it would clearly have potential precedential significance if we have a broad or narrow standard on dismissals without prejudice and whether that's an appealable final order. Do you happen to know, and I'm certainly not going to fault you if you don't, but do you have any thoughts on Justice Kelsey's question about our draft rule amendment and to the extent they might impact this problem we're grappling with in this case?
So we are aware of the amended Rule 1:1 and took a look at it in advance of this case, recognizing that it applies prospectively only, so it won't actually affect this one. We read the rule as essentially tracking what the Court's case law has said that Mr. Walton cited in his brief on whether the judgment leaves anything for the Court to be done and has terminated the case on the merits between the parties. We don't think it changes our argument in the case, because when it goes to whether it leaves something for the Court to be done, is there something that can still be done in the trial court? You know, I think the way we have tried to conceptualize the right way to handle dismissal without prejudice is sort of who has the burden to establish this Court's jurisdiction on appeal. And we think that burden properly rests with the person who seeks to invoke it and with the appellant. And so they need to be able to demonstrate at the time of the appeal that this dismissal is in fact final and has conclusively determined the case.
I mean, just to throw a concrete example, we have a steady stream of cases where pro se inmates don't sue the right party in their habeas. You know, they name the Commonwealth or the Commonwealth attorney or the clerk of court or whoever. And we'll tell them, or the AG's office will say, you named the wrong party, and they stubbornly refuse, and so then it's dismissed without prejudice. Well, oftentimes they have ample time to figure out what the right thing to do. So it seems odd to take up an appeal in that circumstance when there's just an easy fix and they may have ample time to fix it, as opposed to this where, you know, without prejudice, and concretely in the real world without prejudice. So there's a number of sort of iterations of this problem, and I'm not sure a trip up the appellate ladder is the most productive use of anyone's time, whether the litigants, the courts, or anybody.
Justice McCullough, one thing we noticed in preparing for this case was that what part of the problem here is the trial court's order, having already given Mr. Walton a chance to amend, which he took advantage of, but assuming the counterfactual world where the trial court thought he hadn't, the dismissal, as we said in our brief, should have been with prejudice, in our view, at that point. That having been given an opportunity to amend, you didn't take advantage of it.
Right.
That would then create an appealable order, whereas we posited the hypothetical where his initial habeas petition did not facially comply with Code Section 8.01.655, and there, if the trial court had dismissed it without prejudice versus giving him leave to amend, our position would be, well, then he had time to effectuate the proper amendment, file the correct number of copies, and add his prisoner ID number. And so in that context, we wouldn't think that would be an appealable order. And we just think the Fourth Circuit's test gets at that situation and basically allows this court to say, in this case, what was classified as a dismissal without prejudice was, in fact, and probably should have been a dismissal with prejudice, and therefore it's final and appealable. And we recognize that it's a pragmatic, sort of practical approach. The case we submitted as a Rule 5.6a letter yesterday to demonstrate how the test works accounts for a variety of factors, so it doesn't have the benefits of a bright-line rule. But it would provide an administrable standard for this court to make sure it found the appeals that needed to be heard, like this case, for example, versus taking all of the cases that may come up that don't necessarily need appellate review and could be cured in the trial court. So that's why we think it's a good rule. But we do fully agree with Mr. Walton and with several suggestions from the court that this case can be resolved on narrower grounds. And as the court is well aware, the court often will resolve the case on the narrowest and best ground that it needs to. Unless there are further questions, I'll cede the remainder of my time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wiley?
Just very briefly, if the court does decide to adopt the standard that's been advocated for the director, I wanted to articulate the narrowest grounds for resolving this case using that standard. The fact that this was a procedural dismissal, that the dismissal was based on a failure to act within 30 days, is the grounds for why it would be a final appealable order. Once the 30-day period came and went, no amended pleading could have gone back and been filed within 30 days. There is also the stand on pleadings principle from the Chow case that within the Domino Sugar framework, someone can forswear the ability to file a future action, stand on the pleadings, and then challenge a ruling that they believe to be erroneous. We believe that's a strong rule that would guard against litigation and repetitive actions. So if the court does decide to follow that standard, we believe those are the narrowest and best grounds for resolving this particular matter. We thank the court for its time. And
Mr. Riley, thank you to you and to your firm, Hogan Lovell, for taking this case on a pro bono basis.
Of course,
we always appreciate the bar doing that. You must have done a terrific job. I think you did, because you brought out all the high-caliber guns from the Attorney General. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. Call the next case.